Good morning and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the updated state-level estimates of the Medicaid expansion's coverage and cost under the Affordable Care Act conference call. I would like to inform you that this call is being recorded today, Monday, November 26, 2012. All participants are currently in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, you may indicate you have a question by pressing the pound key followed by the 3 on your push-button telephone. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Diane Rowland. Go ahead.
I'm pleased to be with you all this morning and hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving holiday. But now we're back to work and ready to really look at the choices ahead for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and specifically the Medicaid expansion. Given the Supreme Court decision, many states are now weighing whether to proceed and how to proceed with regard to the Medicaid expansion. And the report we're releasing today provides an update of an analysis we conducted in May of 2010 that looked then at the national and state-by-state impacts of the Medicaid expansion. And I'm pleased today to be here with John Holohan, Matt Butens, Caitlin Carroll, and Stan Dorn of the Urban Institute, who conducted this updated analysis, and we'll go through the key findings with you now, and then we're going to entertain some comments from Alan Weil, who's the Executive Director of the National Academy of State Health Policy, on the state perspective on many of these findings, and then open it up to your questions and discussion. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to John Holohan and his team at Urban to walk us through the key findings from this analysis as well as the way in which the study was conducted. John.
Okay, I'm going to assume that everyone has access to the slides, which I think are available to you. And I'm not going to go through every one in detail, but I want to hit the main things in the report. Overall, the idea was to estimate the effect at the state level of the Medicaid expansion in the ACA, assuming that all states implement the expansion, and compare that to where we would be if there was no Affordable Care Act, look at the effect on federal and state spending, coverage of current and new eligibles. The key to understanding this report, I think, is that there are really two parts. If no states expand Medicaid, there will still be an increase in coverage and an increase in spending for both federal and state governments. That's because there will be exchanges. There'll be the no wrong door provision, which essentially if people go to the exchange, they will be, and they're really eligible for Medicaid, they'll be routed to Medicaid. The various outreach and simplification procedures, the individual mandate that could have a spillover effect. So there's a lot of reasons to expect that Medicaid will grow a bit, even if no state adopts the expansion. And then secondly, there is a decision to expand. What would happen if states do increase coverage? So we estimate both what happens with no states adopting the expansion and then the incremental effects if they do by state. We look at the impact on federal and state spending. We estimate uncompensated care. We look, although we're not going to talk about it, at the special case of hospitals and what their revenues would be if states adopted coverage. We look at state fiscal effects, that is how much is the new state spending relative to what they now spend in their own budgets. And finally, look at the impacts on enrollment and the impact on the uninsured. The next figure has some things about methods. I'm not going to really go into that too much, except to mention a couple things. That all of the ACA provisions are modeled here. The fact that current eligibles, if there's any new enrollment among them, that will be at the standard federal matching rates. There are all the higher ACA rates for new eligibles, the provisions for the 7 waiver states where the matching rate grows over time up until 2019, and then there's the higher matching rates for CHIP eligibles. We also include in here the savings the states get that no longer continue their limited benefit programs. These people become eligible as for Medicaid as new eligibles. And the 7 prior expansion states, the 7 waiver states that have covered childless adults, they receive the enhanced match and matching rates. there's a number of things that we couldn't estimate. They tend to be all in the direction of having us understate the savings to states or the new cost, or overstating the new costs to states. If we go to figure four, with the first of the slides on the findings, it shows overall Medicaid spending. And it starts with the baseline in the two biggest slices of that pie, saying that states would spend $2.7 billion, and the federal spending would be about $3.7 trillion, overall $7.4 trillion. And on the right-hand side, you can see how much of that is due to the ACA. This is assuming that all states come into the adopt the Medicaid expansion. State spending would increase by $76 billion, or by 2.4%. New federal spending would be $952, or 26%. And over this 10-year period, 2022, new spending would be $1.029 trillion. Figure five, the two bars on the left are just what we just went over, the 952 in federal and 76 in states. If no states adopted the expansion because of the various provisions that will affect Medicaid enrollment, we estimate that state spending will go up by $68 billion or 2.5%, and federal spending by $152 or 4.2%. If states adopt the expansion, if all states do, new state spending would increase by only $8 billion or 0.3%. Federal spending would go up by $800 billion. That $8 billion, I will explain a little bit more how we get there. If we skip to figure seven, you can see the variation in this across states. The report contains data on individual states. We try to summarize this by using regions and use essentially states that are at different places, states that save and states that have the largest increases in spending. On the far left side, overall, that $8 billion translates into a 0.3% increase in spending at the state level. There's a 21% increase in the amount of federal spending. You can see that New England and Middle Atlantic states are actual savers. They save 4.6 and 4.2% respectively. They have smaller increases in federal spending than do other states. What's going on here is that the new coverage is less, but these states are also saving because this is where most of the states that have these limited benefit programs that they can now give up and enroll people in Medicaid as new eligibles. It also includes most of the seven enhanced matching states or prior expansion states that receive an increased match because these states have already covered childless adults. The three groups of states to the right are states that have the biggest coverage expansions. They see the biggest increases in federal spending, and they see increases of state spending in the neighborhood of about 4%. This is relative to what they would have spent had there been no decision to adopt coverage. Figure 8 shows this at the individual state level. The states in white are those who save, either because they're waiver states or because they had limited benefit programs. The states in black are those that have the biggest, tend to have the biggest coverage expansions and the biggest increases in state-level spending relative to what they would have spent in the absence of the expansion. Figure 9, again, takes that $8 billion number on the left side and repeats that. That's the increase in spending in the aggregate at the state level. We then have an estimate of the amount of uncompensated care would be, how much less uncompensated care spending by states would be. We take estimates of the amount of care that is used pre-reform and a second estimate coming from our model of how many fewer uninsured would be and how much less uncompensated care would be. We use previous research by Jack Hadley and others that found that about 30% of uncompensated care is financed by state and local governments. We made the assumption that states couldn't save all of this because of the expansion of coverage, but could save about a third. This means overall we're saving about 10% of the amount of uncompensated care relative to where we are without reform. This saves $18.3 billion, more than offsetting in the aggregate the new spending. So the net saving is about $10.1 billion. For states, this varies a lot among states, as you can see in Figure 10. Again, on the left side, that's the U.S. average, where these numbers are really quite small in the aggregate. The New England and Middle Atlantic states, as we saw before, saw savings. Now their savings are a little bit greater because they get some increase in coverage because of the Medicaid expansion. The states in the South Atlantic, East South Central, and West South Central have the largest increases in Medicaid, thus the most savings on uncompensated care. So when that's taken into consideration, their net new spending is down around 2.5 to 3% of relative to their baseline expenditures. Figure 11 is probably quite important. Because the previous slide says what is new Medicaid spending relative to Medicaid spending, what Medicaid spending would have been. This, on Figure 11, is what is new Medicaid spending relative to general fund expenditures. That is, what they would have spent in the absence of what they're spending on their entire budget. And when you look at this, then the new state spending is really quite small as a percentage of general funds. It falls a bit, about 1% in the New England and Middle Atlantic regions, and increases by about 1% in the states with the largest coverage expansions. In those states, when you take into account the uncompensated care savings, it falls below to less than a 1% increase. So what do we get from this new spending? In Figure 12, there'll be 52.4 million people on Medicaid without the ACA, with the various provisions, but with no state adopting the expansion to 138%, we would get 5.7 million new enrollees. If all states adopted the expansion, it would go to 21.3 million. Figure 13 shows that we'd see quite a reduction in the uninsured. Much of this would happen simply because of the mandate, the exchange, the subsidies that are in the law, but also the Medicaid coverage that would occur even without an expansion. That would reduce the number of uninsured by 28%. The reduction in the uninsured increases to 48% of the uninsured, or 25.3 million people, if all states adopted the expansion. Again, this varies a bit by state, as shown in Figure 14. And where the increases, if states adopted the expansion, would get to about 40% reduction in the uninsured in New England and Middle Atlantic. Remember that these states have low uninsured rates to begin with, so there's less room for new coverage. In the South Atlantic, East South Central, and West South Central, where the Medicaid expansions are the greatest, you see reductions in the uninsured of over 50% if they adopted the expansion, down around 30% if they did not. So the key findings are that if states do adopt the expansion, the federal government will pay for most of this. There will be large gains in Medicaid coverage and substantial reductions in the uninsured. There will be changes in Medicaid enrollment and spending even without adopting the Medicaid expansion. But I think the key finding of this is the additional state costs of the Medicaid expansion is pretty small relative to what spending would be without the expansion, relative to the large increases in federal spending, and relative to state budgets. This picture gets even more favorable if you count the reductions in spending on uncompensated care. And then there's a number of other things that we couldn't account for in this report. Just data was not available that would, I think, bring additional savings to states. So overall, it's hard to conclude anything other than that this is a pretty attractive and should be pretty hard for states eventually, not right away, but eventually to walk away from.
Thank you, John. Now I'm going to turn to Alan Weil for some overview comments.
Thank you, Diane, and once again, I offer my congratulations to Kaiser and the Kaiser Commission for supporting this kind of work and the Urban Institute for conducting it. I think there are really sort of four observations I would make based on the report and the data that have been presented. The first is that it's always very important to look at the cost estimates in context. It is, we're talking about healthcare, and healthcare is expensive, and it's fairly easy to have a little sticker shock at the potential cost of various policy options in this area. But what this report does, I think, very effectively is place the spending burden that states would face if they choose to expand Medicaid in the context of overall spending, particularly general fund spending at the state level. I think many states will be surprised at the results showing that the cost to them of the coverage expansions in the Affordable Care Act come largely from things that they must do, and that the choice about expanding Medicaid actually is a fairly small share of the ultimate cost that states may face. But I think that finding is also a reminder of the importance of not just looking at total costs, but disaggregating where they come from, because many states, when they talk about the potential costs of the Medicaid expansion, are actually lumping together all costs and not just looking at the effects of expansion. The only other bit of context that is, of course, important at the state level is that even 1% of general fund is a lot of money. Yeah, states are still digging their way out of the major fiscal downturn that occurred in their finances 3 and 4 years ago. States have not fully recovered, even though the trend lines right now are quite positive in the overwhelming majority of states. But it means that there's a great deal of deferred attention to other priorities like education, infrastructure, public safety, that have been lining up for years. And so even though the relative shares are small, the absolute demands on state government are really quite significant. The second major observation out of this report is the importance, as particularly the reporters are looking at the various estimates people are putting out to help analyze this issue, the importance of understanding the assumptions that are built into the estimates. And two of them particularly stand out here as ones that I think are handled in a far more sophisticated and honest way than appears in some of the results that have been reported in various places. The first is the estimates with respect to take-up rates. The cost of the expansion is very sensitive to the percentage of those who are made eligible who actually elect to be covered. And as the report notes, in these micro-simulation results, these are not just plugged-in estimated numbers. They are actually calculated numbers based on the characteristics of the people who are going to gain coverage. And that's a much more sophisticated and helpful way to think about what take-up is going to be than just taking some round number that fits in a spreadsheet to say this is how many people will take up the coverage. Similarly, the cost estimates for the newly covered play a huge role in estimating the overall cost of the expansion. And again, I think in many instances, people take fairly broad brush historical estimates to try to figure out what future costs will be. And so I would just encourage reporters who are comparing these numbers with those that may come out from other sources to look at all of the assumptions that are built in, but in particular, I think these two, the micro-simulation really shows its power. The third observation is that as much as we can't help but coming back to the numbers, we all know that this is far more than a fiscal exercise, and looking at the cost in the context of the number of people who are being covered is critical. We know that being uninsured leads to excess illness burden and premature death. We know that many states for decades have been working using either their own funding or options provided by the federal government to try to reduce the number of people without health insurance. And so while figuring out the cost of this policy is very important, there is a human dimension that needs to be a part of the discussion far beyond just the dollars. And my final observation is really based on the debates today in Washington, which is how critical confidence at the state level about how the federal government is going to handle Medicaid spending in the future, how critical that is to states making decisions that they can feel comfortable about. These estimates are built around a financing model that is in current statute, and that's the appropriate model to use. But states are very nervous about the possibility of those formulas changing. And although it is certainly the case that states can change their mind, they can adopt the Medicaid expansion at one point, and then if the federal funding becomes more limited, they can reverse that decision. That is a painful course of action, and states really do want to be able to plan ahead. So the sooner we can reach some closure on whether or not the financial arrangement in the ACA is going to be stable, I think the easier it will be for states to make decisions for the long run. So those are my observations, but overall, I just think it's very timely and very useful information. States are going to be confronting this decision mostly in early 2013, and this will be very helpful for students.
Thank you, Alan. And I would encourage all on the call to actually look to the full report where there are tables that break down these regional differences by state so that you can really see how the numbers work at the state level. With that, we're going to open the phone to your questions. If you have a particular person you want to address it to in terms of John or Alan, please do that. Otherwise, we will try and field the questions as best we can.
Thank you. The question and answer session will begin at this time. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing any numbers. Should you have a question, please press the pound key followed by the 3 on your push-button telephone. If you wish to withdraw your question, you can do so again by pressing the pound key followed by the 3 on your telephone. Your questions will be taken in the order they are received. Please stand by. Our first question comes from Caleb Hellerman. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you. Thank you all. I guess this question is really for John. I realize the analysis only goes out to 2020.
Caleb, could you identify the organization you're
I'm
with?
Sorry. Sorry, this is Caleb Hellerman with CNN. Thanks for taking the question. I realize the analysis runs only to 2022, but is there any, I mean, once the federal government's share goes down, you know, to 90%, I mean, how, generally speaking, do you have a sense of how the picture changes, you know, if we're talking about long-term projections?
Yeah, actually, in the report, and there's only so much we could cover here, but we present results for both 2016 and 2022, 2016 being an example of when states have the 100% match and they have should be pretty close to the fully phasing in their coverage expansion, and then also 2022. And clearly, the state share goes up a bit, but not tremendously so, but it's definitely more so. And I, you know, maybe I could, you know, point to particular numbers later if you wanted to reach me, but we do have that, and that is clearly an issue when you present 10-year numbers. People say, well, what does it really look like when we have to pay the full 10%? So we're pretty careful to present that in a number of the tables.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jim Engel from Fox News.
Hi there. I think this is for you, John. I'm not quite clear what happens to people who would, had the states expanded to 138%, but if they do not, what happens to that population of people? Do they have to purchase insurance on their own in order to get subsidies? What happens to those people who would have been in the covered population if the states do not expand?
Well, those with incomes between 100 and 138 can go into exchanges, and some of them will, and some could get coverage through their employers. But those below 100% have very few options. Matt, do you want to add anything?
Yes. And a lot of those below 100% would also be exempt from the individual mandate. But those between 100 and 138, if they had an offer of coverage from their employer that is deemed affordable under the law, that would be their option. Otherwise, they would be eligible for subsidized private coverage in the exchanges.
They would have to buy insurance in order to get
subsidies. Likely remain uninsured.
I'm sorry?
The people who are below 100% of poverty would likely remain uninsured.
Okay. And those above would have to buy insurance in order to get the subsidy?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, the subsidy's not available.
Right,
below 100%.
Right. They could choose not. They could choose not.
Those
to
above 100.
They could choose not to purchase. Some of them would not. Some of them would be exempt from the individual mandate. Some of them would not be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Elizabeth Stawicki from Minnesota Public Radio. Go ahead, ma'am.
I had just a quick question, and I apologize if you've covered this before, but is there any reason why the Midwest states are not included in some of the figures like 7, 11, and 14?
We were trying to not have too much information on the slides, and so we picked the states that had the least that were least affected and those that were most affected, and they tended to be in the first case in New England and Middle Atlantic states, and the other point about for them is to show that actually they most of them were saving, and then the states in the South had the biggest coverage expansion, so we showed them. But in this report, there are detailed tables for that show the results for every single state,
including Minnesota.
Definitely including Minnesota.
Next question.
Thank you. Okay, our next question comes from David Morgan from Reuters.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. It's simply this: what is the latest count on the number of states that have said they will not participate in the Medicaid expansion?
That's actually unclear. Many of the states are making their decision now as they look at the results of the election and as they start to put together their, the governors start to put together their budgets for introduction in January. But, you know, some states have declared that they won't go forward, but I think what we would hope is that they would take a look at the results in this report and be able to really deal with their legislatures and their other groups in the state to decide whether to go forward or not.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, what they decide to do at first very well may not be where they end up, because the economics of this are very strongly in favor of adopting the expansion. And if for political reasons people don't want to do it, clearly I think providers will and other groups will eventually put pressure on states. And so the early decisions that are made are not likely, you know, it could be very different than the ones that are made a few years out.
So there are 8 states that have said they would not participate, but I think now one would expect everybody to be reevaluating and to move forward
depending on the way in which they provide their analysis at the state level. And we hope these numbers are helpful to the states as they look both at the impact on the number of uninsured in the state as well as the state cost.
Thanks very much.
This is Alan Weil. If I could just jump in. All of that is correct. I just add two things. One is that with the exchanges, there is a firm deadline that the federal government has set up for states to express their intention, and the expression needs to come from the governor. That's different in Medicaid, where states can submit their plans and intentions to change their Medicaid program at any time. So it doesn't create quite the same forcing deadline. And second of all, the decision-making process is much more complex, or potentially more complex, here, where it may be a budget that is the expression of the decision here. There may be a state statute. There are actually states that already have on the books that states will implement federal changes in Medicaid law. So it becomes a more complex dynamic. And what most of what people are going on when they say whether the state is going to do it is the governor's public announcement, often made just a couple of days after the Supreme Court decision, when this was a brand new issue. So I think we all expect this to play out over time.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sarah Cliff from The Washington Post.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I think this is for John. I was curious if you could explain Figure 5 a little more, and kind of the part I was curious about is that $68 billion in increased state Medicaid spending, if no one does the expansion, kind of what that's coming from, and if you could walk through in a little more detail why the difference is, seems to be relatively small with state spending in terms of the expansion versus not the expansion.
So, okay, so what this slide does in the second and third set of bars is to decompose the overall effect into what would happen if they don't adopt the expansion and what happens if they decide to go to 138. So the middle bars are saying that there's a lot of provisions in the law that will affect Medicaid even without an expansion. For example, if you go to an exchange and have an income below 138% in your family, you will be directed to Medicaid. There are various provisions to simplify eligibility for Medicaid. There's a lot of outreach efforts. There's the individual mandate where that doesn't apply to most of these people, but are what we know from Massachusetts is that people are aware of it and may think it applies to them or may think it is what they're expected to do. So for a variety of reasons, there will be new enrollment. I think the number was 5.7 million new enrollees we estimate will come in to Medicaid, even if a state says, no, I'm not going to expand. That is matched at the standard matching rates, which means that it's not 100% federal match for those people. It's new enrollment among people who are currently eligible. So those various provisions that I mentioned will bring in more enrollment among people who now are eligible for Medicaid. And that new enrollment or that higher participation is what will cost states some money and bring in federal money. There's also the increase in the matching rate in the CHIP program, which will save states some money and add to federal money.
And Sarah, just going back to Alan's point earlier, participation rates are what's important, and many of the current eligible Medicaid population in the state may not be fully participating, but all the other activities going around the setting up of the exchange, the simplification of the Medicaid eligibility process and enrollment process means that more of those who are not participating but currently eligible will be coming into the program. And this especially affects children because the eligibility levels for children in the state have been much higher than those of the adults. So this is really boosting participation among children, who are currently eligible for the Medicaid program, as well as a few of the adults who gets left out if the state elects not to expand coverage, is really largely an adult population for which the federal government was going to be paying the bulk of the cost as new eligibles. And those are mostly individuals who are adults without dependent children or parents who are substantially below the eligibility levels for the children who qualify for Medicaid.
And if I could ask one quick follow-up question, can you walk through what's in the $8 billion? That, is that just, you know, when the match drops in a few years, that's spending, or what's in the $8 billion? What's the difference?
The $8 billion is the new state costs for new eligibles. So at zero at first, it grows to 10%. What else is in that?
The cumulative cost to the state for those made newly eligible by the expansion.
But it also includes the savings from states that no longer have are now paying for a program with limited benefits that they will no longer cover, and then those people will be covered as new eligible. So there's savings to states there.
And then.
Right.
Great. Thank you so much.
Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, should you have a question, please press the pound key followed by the 3 on your push button telephone. Our next question comes from Jerry Dremsky from the Buffalo News.
Hi, thank you for doing the call. You talked a little bit generally about why some of the states will benefit from this, but I was wondering if someone could be specific about New York and why New York would stand to benefit.
New York is an interesting state in that they have already covered childless adults up to 100% of poverty. Those people are considered a prior expansion group, so the matching rate on them will increase from the current 50% to 75%, and then on up to eventually 90%. They will have a small number of new enrollees among the childless adults between 100 and 138% of poverty, and for those, there will be the very high matching rate starting at 100 that phase down to 90%. And then New York will also experience some new enrollment among current eligibles that we just talked about. For those, they will have a the standard matching rate. So New York sort of has all three of the different kinds of populations the states could have.
This is Matt. We actually issued a report focusing on New York State and the ACA this past spring.
Okay.
And you can get that on our website, healthpolicycenter.org. And that's sort of a more detailed New York-specific look at the effects of the ACA.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Pear from the New York Times.
Thank you. I think this may be for Diane. Does Medicaid now supplement employer-sponsored insurance for some people? And do you see
Robert, we're having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay, I'll try again. Does Medicaid now supplement employer-sponsored insurance for some people? And do you see any role for Medicaid in the future in supplementing employer-sponsored insurance for employees who get premium tax credits?
John?
I'm sure I understand that.
Is the question whether Medicaid currently supplements employer-based insurance?
Yes.
Is that premium assistance program? Is that what you're
saying? Well, currently there are in some states premium assistance programs.
Right.
But
yes, this is Matt. Under the ACA, states are required to evaluate whether or not premium assistance will be cost-effective if extended to adults. So states will be looking at whether or not that is an option for them, but that those that has not those estimates. I'm not aware that they have currently been done. So possibly, but it's a bit too early to tell.
Thank you.
But that is not a factor in the analysis that we presented today.
Correct.
And this is Alan. And just to note that although Medicaid is the payer of last resort, it also can wrap around even if it's not a premium support option. So if you have people, particularly people in need of long-term services and supports who have employer coverage, they certainly may get some Medicaid benefits that provide services not covered by the employer.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Becca Aronson from ACA Medicaid Expansion.
Hi, I'm actually from the Texas Tribune. my question today, I was wondering if you could give some more details about Texas, given that we have the highest rate of uninsured and also pretty low eligibility requirements. And then I also had a question for Alan, more specifically about people in Texas seem to be looking at ways to go around the governor and expand Medicaid anyways, either at the local level through counties or through a constitutional amendment. Are any of these possible, and if so, what could they look like?
Let me answer the question about Texas. I could probably guide you to numbers specifically on Texas if you were to call later today. Or one of my colleagues could, but you'll get a pretty good idea of what happens to Texas if you look at the West-South Central region in each of the slides where we show regional effects. And Texas tends to dominate that region, so it would, the other states in there are Louisiana, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, and they're not all that different. So you get a pretty good idea of what would happen to Texas if you looked at the West-South Central results in the figures.
And this is Alan. Under federal law, Medicaid has to be administered by a state single state agency, and so all Medicaid policy has to be set and approved at the state level. It's the state that submits the plans to the federal government. We do have an experience right now with California having received a waiver to do some county-based expansions, but that's a very different context. It was granted prior to the Supreme Court's decision. It was granted as a way for states, for counties to ramp up toward the Medicaid expansion, which is a fundamentally different idea than having a patchwork of some counties in the state having an expansion and some counties not. There's really no precedent for that kind of approach. I'm not sure what the constitutional amendment is that you're thinking about, but at the end of the day, any waiver-based policy would have to be approved not only by the federal government, but submitted by the state.
And this is Matt. So just looking at Texas state-specific numbers, this is table ES2 in our full report. Texas would see a 3.5% increase in state spending and a 27.4% increase in federal spending. So it is like the region that John pointed out, though the state spending increase is actually a little bit lower than that region overall.
To put it in dollar terms, it's $5.7 billion in new state dollars, and it would bring in $65.6 billion in federal dollars.
And cover lots of people.
So how does that compare to other states generally?
That is typical of states in the South, that they would put up somewhere on the order of 3.5 to 4.5% of over what they would have otherwise spent, and brings in pretty substantial amounts of federal dollars. So that is fairly typical of Southern and a number of the mountain region states.
And as a result, would have over half of their uninsured population reduced.
Yes, absolutely right.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Phil Gilwitz from KHN.
Not sure what that is.
John, can you talk about why is the 21 million figure on how many people will gain Medicaid, why is that different from the 17 million figure we've heard from CBO? Is that because the time frame is different, or what's going on there? And I have a follow-up for Alan.
CBO, our enrollment numbers are different. If I remember right, they have very little growth in their estimate of Medicaid enrollment out over time, and we didn't find that plausible, and we have pretty much the same increase in coverage in 2014, but in our model, it grows a bit for as it has been because of income declines and so on that we expect will continue to draw more and more people into Medicaid. Anything you want to add to that, Matt?
They are two separate models, and the assumptions we made are in the methods section of this paper, and if there are more detailed questions, the full methodology documentation of our model is publicly available.
The other specific question, what is the take-up or participation rate that you assume? What percentage of people who would be eligible will actually sign up?
Okay. Now, that, as Ellen pointed out earlier, the take-up on our model depends on the characteristics of the actual people who have the choice whether or not to enroll. Looking at it more broadly, the take-up rates depend, for example, I mean, the biggest single factor is whether or not you have coverage now. So for those who are uninsured and who become newly eligible, the overall take-up rate is about 73%. Okay. Now, that can that varies depending on who you are and what you would gain from coverage in the model. But as an overall rate for those who start out uninsured and who gain eligibility, that's the level.
Okay. Alan, I wonder if you could just touch on briefly about the idea that states will still have a significant increase in their Medicaid costs even if they decide to not expand. Do you think most states' legislatures and governors realize that, or are they looking at this as if they don't expand, they don't have any expansion, they don't have any extra costs?
That's a really good question. I have not done a systematic enough look at what analyses have been prepared about costs, and to answer that with any sort of general, statement about what states are looking at. I think states have been they've done a lot of work on the costs of bringing up exchanges because the federal government's paying for that in the short run, but they have to be self-sustaining in the long run. I think much of the Medicaid analysis has been focused on the expansion, but I do know states have been looking at the costs even without. Remember also that part of, as John noted earlier, one of the big factors is the simplification of eligibility standards, and states have to, that's something that doesn't happen automatically. States have to go through major information technology enhancements and investments to reprogram. And so they've been doing a lot of work in this area. How much they've actually tried to estimate enrollment effects, I'm not certain.
But this is Diane. Those are also provisions that are not subject to the Supreme Court decision. They are part of the standing ACA that was upheld. So that much of the simplification activity, as John has noted, will go on whether a state elects to expand or not to the new eligible population.
Diane, can you just touch on what simplification, in layman's terms, like what changes that will make it easier for people to sign up?
Well, clearly it's the simplification of the way in which eligibility will be determined in terms of the income reforms. It's also the screen and enroll, that if they show up at an exchange, they can be screened and enrolled there for the Medicaid program. And they can do applications online. It's all of the things that have been tried and worked on for many years with regard to children that would now be applied to parents, the end of face-to-face interviews and other things.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maureen Grope from Gannett.
Hi, I wondered if you could go into more detail on what is different in this report than the one you did 2 years ago. Are you doing different types of calculations, or are you using updated figures, or something else?
The model is a lot more sophisticated because of the various improvements we've made. This two-part issue is dealt with. That was never an issue before. That is that much of the expansion of coverage among current eligibles will occur regardless of whether states make this decision to adopt. And then the second part is the decision to adopt coverage. There is more recent data, more up-to-date cost information. And in the previous report, if you're familiar with it, we made two different estimates, one that calibrated closely to CBO and another one that was somewhat higher. We started out in this with the same intention, but our basic model estimates of federal spending increases were so close to CBO that we didn't do a second set. What else? That's
well, and this report includes children, whereas the first report focused only on adults.
Correct. And also, there were different assumptions made about the ramp-up of new enrollment in the first years of expansion. In this report, we looked carefully at what kinds of potential new enrollees would enroll at what rate, because they're not all going to come on board in 2014. So that enrollment will gradually ramp up through the first years of implementation.
One other thing that's important to mention is that in the previous report, we didn't make any estimates of the state savings because of reductions in the uninsured and thus less uncompensated care, and didn't really have much of a discussion of various other ways that we couldn't measure that where states could save money, and that that discussion is in there, as are estimates of the savings from uncompensated care, reduction in uncompensated care.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. Okay, our next question comes from Jonathan Shapiro from WABI.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I wanted to talk to you about Figure 9 in particular. I wanted to see if you had specific numbers for Georgia. We're Atlanta's NPR station. Do you have specific numbers for Georgia in terms of its savings and uncompensated care costs if the state goes ahead with the expansion?
Well, we do. They're in the report. Let me see if I can find them.
And while you're looking for that, I mean, if you could just talk in general, you know, about it, given the state's high uninsured rate. I mean, I heard you talking about Texas's, Georgia's is the second or third on that list in uninsured rate. How many would be newly covered regardless of the expansion, according to the report?
In Georgia.
Yeah. That would probably be an easier thing to deal with later. I mean, we'd have to dig around and try to find it. The other numbers you asked about, we estimated that this would be billions, so $2.5 billion in new spending over the 10 years in Georgia. The offsetting savings would be $726 million, so a net increase of $1.8 billion or a 4.1% increase in state spending.
And so can you break down where those savings in uncompensated care will come from?
Not on a state-by-state basis. States, the uncompensated care in states tends to get paid for, first of all, it's paid for in different ways, but it's paid for through state grants to hospitals and clinics, state share of disproportionate share hospital payments,
as state support of medical schools and teaching hospitals, much of which, or some of which, is exists because of uncompensated care. And then some states have indigent care programs or support localities, indigent care programs. So it depends on the state. So this is sort of an average applied in the same way to all states.
Okay, and if there's a question on enrollment as well. So that is on Table 9 of the main report, so other states can look at the lines for their state. For Georgia, we have an additional, so if Georgia does not expand under the ACA, there will be an increased enrollment of about 157,000. And if they do expand, the increase in enrollment will be 855,000. So you can look at the enrollment numbers in more detail, and those from other states can look at Table 9.
Okay. Alan, are you still on?
I am.
I know you need to go, so I was wondering if you wanted to make any final comment, and then we'll take another question.
No, I think this has been a great set of questions, and I think the state specific questions to follow up separately are terrific, I appreciate being a part of the conversation.
Great, thank you. Okay, we'll move to our next question, and we'll take two more questions, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Okay. Our next question comes from Rose Hoban from NC Health News.
When I talk to the lawmakers in my state about their misgivings about expanding Medicaid, one of the things I hear from them continually is that they're worried that after the six-year period where the Fed is paying most of this, that it'll revert back to a higher rate, and then the state will get quote-unquote slammed by high costs. And I'm sorry that Alan jumped off, because he mentioned during his portion of the call that, this is a concern by states and that there needs to be some clarification at the federal level. What's kind of keeping that clarification from taking place? Sort of what are the factors that are...
The federal government, the law is quite clear that this matching rate continues at 90% after... infinitely. I think what Alan was referring to is that we're also in the process of a debate over the fiscal cliff and over balancing the budget and the deficit, and that states are concerned there that in those negotiations they not either lose some of their current Medicaid financing or have reductions in what might be available. So it's more a concern about how the fiscal deficit discussions are going to go on, as opposed to concern about needing clarification that the ACA will go on infinitely.
And that's very clear in the law, because I was hearing that even before there were really large discussions about the fiscal cliff.
Well, it is clear in the law that the matching goes on, but Congress obviously can change laws, and I think that was where the concern you were hearing came from.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But there's the federal matching structure has been in place for a very long time, and despite, budget issues, and has never been changed. It's something that one can't rule out, but it seems fairly implausible, particularly since people from these same states would have to vote on it.
And also, this is Matt. Not expanding Medicaid would not insulate your state from those sort of Medicaid cuts. As you can see in our figures, most of the spending on Medicaid is for the population that would enroll even without the ACA. So it's just the question of, will expanding Medicaid leave the state open to higher cuts than otherwise, and that actually isn't clear. That depends on how those cuts, which are currently hypothetical, get issued.
Gotcha.
But I also think that the concern over Medicaid reductions is not limited to the ACA-related provisions. It's a concern about the program as a whole and what might come out of any fiscal cliff debates and changes, and there's a lot more at stake in the state's share and the state's contribution from the federal government to the current Medicaid program than to either the current eligibles who might come on under the ACA or the new eligibles coming on from the ACA. So that's where I would think Alan would say, and all of us would say, much of the state concern is today. Okay, a final question.
Thank you. Okay, our final question comes from Mary Shedden from the Tampa Tribune.
Hi, thank you. We were looking a lot at the different state numbers, but I'm really curious why the states with really significant cost increases like Florida are being affected. Is it more about the population or the economics of the state, or is it about the policies and the way the states are administering Medicaid currently? Can you give a little idea of why the states that are really impacted significantly are so?
Well, it tends to be states that have the biggest impact are states that have the strictest eligibility standards now. So to go to a uniform standard of 138% of poverty means a bigger expansion of coverage for them and more federal dollars and more, even though it's still small, I mean, those are the states that would see some increase in their own spending. So it is really a function of, where states would go with the expansion is set and uniform nationally at 138%, but the distance between where you are now and 138% depends on, your current coverage standard. So states in the South tend to have cover people to lower percents of poverty, and so therefore would have the biggest coverage expansions.
In effect, the states with the largest uninsured populations who gain the most coverage also have somewhat more costs because they haven't had the coverage in the past. So it's closing this gap that causes the increase. Okay.
So it's not just one factor, it's multiple factors.
It's multiple factors, but it's largely related to, as John put it, how many people are covered under the current standards. So if you're a state that only covers adults up to 35% of the federal poverty level, you're going to be adding a lot more people between 35% and 138% of poverty than a state like New York that's already covering people well over the poverty level.
I mean, one footnote to that is if a state like Florida would have a big coverage expansion, but all of those new people will be at the much higher federal matching rates. If a comparable state, let's say, one in the Northeast, had much broader coverage and has a much smaller increase in their eligibility standards to get to 138, they would have more people covered at the lower current matching rates and a smaller share at the new matching rates. So it really is very advantageous to the states with low levels of coverage today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone who joined us on the conference call, and especially to thank John and his team for both this analysis and for the presentation today. And to encourage those of you who have the full report to look up the states you're interested in the full report and to see how much more detail is there than we were able to present in this brief period. And please let us know if you have additional questions and would like any follow-up because we think this is a very important report and hope that you'll digest it and also help to disseminate the results. So thank you all for participating today.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the conference for today. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.